Hi, everybody. This is Mark Ceffardini with Go See Talk. Welcome back to the podcast. Man, we're excited to speak to our next guest, James Cullen Bresak. He is a director, producer, the dynamo behind the camera. And if you look at his resume, you can't believe that one person did everything that he's touched on. What we're going to be discussing on today's podcast is his new movie, Fortress, starring Bruce Willis and Chad Michael Murray. But James, Mr. Bresak, please welcome to the show. How's your day going? How's your year winding down?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You know, my day's going good. It's nice here in LA. It's not quite winter. It's kind of like this ambiguous type of season right now. It's slightly cold, but like cold in LA is like 65. So it's like, you know, it's just kind of is.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a good day. It's a beautiful morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Yeah, I can share the at least from a climate standpoint, I can share some similarities. I'm in Dallas, and usually we say that we have four seasons. We have summer, a longer summer, and those 3 days in February. But usually, whenever it gets below 68 degrees, everybody just goes, "Oh, damn, grab your parka, it's freezing out."
So. Yeah. No, I know it's interesting because like when I was in New York, I was able to like walk around in like pretty much like Arctic temperatures, you know, in New York City during the winter and like a t-shirt and jeans, but like, you know, drops below 60 over here and I need a jacket.
Man, you do so much running around. I bet you never chill or need anything to keep your blood pumping. Let's jump right into it. What excites you about film? What got you started? What are your sacred films and what did you grow up with?
Yeah, so I mean, I started getting into movies at like a very, very young age. Like I was like a walking IMDb. Like I wanted to like memorize like everybody who was in stuff. I wanted to win 6 degrees to Kevin Bacon with friends. You know, like I wanted to be able to like do those movie trivia things. And I watched a lot of movies. I grew up around film. And my dad was a 3-time Emmy Award winning writer of like Pinky and the Brain and Animaniacs and Tiny Toons and a bunch of other stuff. And he, you know, instilled a love of movies and storytelling into me. And so like, you know, I spent most of my childhood, you know, watching movies with him and we would dissect them together. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was really little, he would pause the movie, you know, I'm like 5-6 years old and he'd start asking me questions about like the movie, you know, like, hey, I thought it was like, you know, to see if I was paying attention because, you know, at that age, you have like such a short attention span, but it was really like he was asking me like, you know, motivation of characters, like why is somebody doing something. So it's like instilled at like that age where like you're learning, like still learning language. And so like I guess I learned the language of film at that same age, you know. So it was kind of beautiful in that sense. And you know, I've just always loved movies. You know, I will say that probably the movie going experience that stuck with me the most was when I went to go see Kill Bill in theaters. I was like 12 years old. My dad took me and they did not want me to go into the theater. Like the ticket taker stopped me. This was at like the Grove in LA. Ticket taker stopped me. The manager stopped me. Like everybody was not trying to have me go in. They're like, do you know that this movie is unbelievably violent? Blah, blah, blah. Like it was like the day after it came out. And my dad was like, yeah, that's why I'm taking him to see it. I remember I went to see that movie and sitting in the theater, I was like, man, this, like I felt like I had like gotten away with something, like I had like, you know, like robbed a bank or something. I'm like sitting there with like this like giddiness and I'm like, oh man, you know, like it's just like films were like dangerous. It was like this crazy thing that like, you know, people didn't want you to see, and I loved the idea of that, you know. And so I just fell in love. Really, that was the moment when I decided like I really needed to be a filmmaker.
Well, it's so funny you mentioned that. I have a similar experience. I snuck into Pulp Fiction with a friend of mine about the age of 12. And we were sitting there looking around and somebody came in right as Harvey Keitel's character walks in and we just got all this. we played it cool and nobody knew we were 12. So definitely set us on I've watched, you know, like The Thing and Animal House. And I credit my dad for showing me equally, you know, cool stuff at a young age. But so is Tarantino your ride or die filmmaker? Do you have what's your favorite Tarantino film?
So, I mean, my favorite Tarantino film is Kill Bill. Volume One. But Tarantino is not my ride or die. I believe me, I love the films of Quentin Tarantino, but like, I, you know, if I was to go into like my top two filmmakers that like, or three filmmakers that have been able to do no wrong in my eyes so far, is like, you know, you look at like Martin Scorsese, Park Chan-wook, who Korean filmmaker did Old Boy, and he's, I mean, he's everything he's done, the whole Vengeance trilogy, Joint Security Area, you know, Thirst, like everything he's done has been flawless. Even the American movie he made, Stoker, which I feel like is completely underrated, that movie is just like a cinematic masterpiece. And then, you know, I would also venture to say Robert Rodriguez, just because he's so versatile in what he does and yet still keeps his flavor in it. It's amazing to see like that same tone from like El Mariachi and Desperado, like going into the Spy Kids movies. And like, you know, it, like, but it's fun. It works for kids. And also Sin City is just like a masterpiece. When you talk about like movies that are like a comic book movie, Sin City is like, I grew up reading those graphic novels, and like, it's the exact same thing on the screen. Like it's, you know, the little liberties here and there, but like every shot you're like, I remember that from the comic because it looks so much like it in every way. So, you know, I think, I would definitely go with them. Tarantino's in there. He'd be in my top 10, but definitely not the highest echelon for me, even though Kill Bill will forever be one of my top five movies.
And that's something to hold on to just because of how much it means to you and how it, you know, sets you on your path. But, you know, when you start talking about Double R, I mean, that's a guy, master of all trades. I mean, he shoots, he cuts, he composes, he directs, he even acts. So it's, very few like him.
Yeah, I know. Like, so Robert Rodriguez for me, like, you know, I mean, that's kind of like a path that I like tried to follow. Cause I was like, you know, when I was 18 years old, straight out of high school, I made my first feature film. And I was like, Robert Rodriguez only needed $7,000 to get his career started, to make his first feature. That's all I need. So like, I went out and got like $7,000 and made my movie. It was called My Pure Joy, and it's unwatchable. It's like one of the worst movies ever made that I made. Nobody should ever watch it. Please avoid it at all costs. But it was definitely like, that was my film school, because like everything I learned not to do from making that movie is like what I've like carried on further. Cause like, you know, that, I mean, for instance, the movie's like 115 minutes, and it's like a slasher film that should have been maybe like 80 minutes. You know, it's like, it's an unbelievably long film for no reason. but you know, Robert Rodriguez, definitely, like, I mean, that's when you talk about like an indie filmmaker that like, you know, should inspire any and all filmmakers, I think that's the guy. I mean, he really, when you talk about self-starters who went out there and just did it, I mean, that guy really just did it. You know, he came from nothing and made that movie, and is built from there, and he's always marched to the beat of his own drum. I gotta have so much respect for the guy.
Yeah, I've gotten to speak to his composer, Carl Thiel, over the years, and he's done Machete Kills. He's done the sequel to Kill Bill to Sin City with Robert. And yeah, he speaks much to the praise that you're speaking to. But you know, it's funny. It's amazing how without being in the film industry, just seeing it from the consumer side of it. You know, you see how things can be done quicker, how editing software can speed up the process. And even to the point where I've heard Ridley Scott say, I think I'm paraphrasing, he just holds up a phone and he goes, this, you have a production studio in your pocket. You have no excuse now. Go out and make something. So it's kind of, it's awesome that the barrier to entry has literally disappeared.
I mean, I would agree. I fully believe in that. I mean, I directed, the third feature I did. I did it at like, I was 19 or maybe 20 at the time. Shot the whole thing on an iPhone. The whole movie, it was like a $500 budget. And it's like a feature film. It's available on some of the streaming services and stuff. And you know, so I agree. Like, you know, I'm a firm believer if you know, if you want to make a movie, go out there and make it, you know? And the one thing is like, don't set yourself up for failure. Right. So like, if you only have like a $500 budget and an iPhone, don't try and make Jurassic Park. You know what I mean? Like, you know, that's where I feel like a lot of people shoot themselves in the foot. If they try to make these grandiose things that are outside of the scope of what they can do, versus like, I think like, you know, figure out what you can do and what you have within the realm of your budget if you're first starting out, and really play to those strong suits and then build from there in the future. You know, I don't think like if you can't afford to have a really cool creature, you know, don't make a creature movie, you know, if unless you have some really great ability of doing that on your own, building the creature, and you have that skill set, you know, mazel tov, do that. But if not, like, you know, I would say don't make a creature movie if you can't have a cool creature. Like it's you know, that's just my two cents is play towards your strong suits.
Well, man, I love how this jumped into film school 101 today. I appreciate it. I have a 100-page screenplay that I'm trying to shop around. So now I know I need to not include the stuff that doesn't make it a reality. So no, that's awesome. That's awesome. So you're going to be 30 next year. You've achieved tremendous. I mean, you've worked with Bruce Willis and DMX and Steven Seagal before you turned a big 3-0. So, I mean, God damn, what's next? I mean, how do you, is slowing down even an option for you?
You know, I mean, you know, for me, I'm very blessed that I've been able to work with such wonderful people and have the support of, you know, the people that I've worked with in order to, you know, continue working, and that the people that I've worked with have enjoyed working with me enough and enjoyed the movies I've made enough to bring me back. You know, a lot of the film companies that I work with, I've done multiple films with, and you know, so I've been very blessed in that sense. You know, and the way I look at it is, you know, I'm still building. My dad always told me, especially when, you know, I started making movies, like actual movies, that like, you know, at some point, you know, everything I do would be, you know, known as my early films, because I was, you know, doing a lot at the time. And you know, I definitely have really taken that into consideration and to heart, because like, you know, I feel like I'm just getting started. Like a lot of, you know, I found my footing a few years ago and started really like, you know, capitalizing on like a style that I feel like I've built across my movies and stuff. But you know, and you know, a lot of the early works of mine, I feel like I was definitely trying to find my voice as a filmmaker. I knew I wanted to make movies, but I was trying to find my voice. And you know, so I think it's just been like a fun sandbox, and I've just been kind of, you know, figuring things out. And so as I build and as I grow, I mean, I don't see the point in slowing down, because I've just, you know, I enjoy learning so much from the wonderful people that I get to work with. And, you know, film is a living, breathing thing. It's a collaborative medium. And you know, I'm surrounded by so many brilliant minds all the time. And so it's just amazing to be able to, like, you know, take things and learn things from everybody around you. I mean, you know, the last movie I just directed, Mel Gibson was in, and you know, I learned a lot from him. I mean, that he's a phenomenal director. So it's, you know, it's just one of those things that it's just, it's amazing to be able to work with such brilliant minds and be able to learn so much. So when I would say, you know, am I getting started? I believe 30 is probably am I, you know, slowing down? I would say I'm just getting started. I think 30 is the start of my film career.
It may sound like we're wrapping this up. No, we are just getting started. Fortress. Let's just jump right into Fortress, James.
Let's talk about Fortress.
Yeah. It feels like a Sunday afternoon movie, like just short of a midnight movie. It's fun. Cast is great. And it is like lightning fast. But please tell us about it, because you've worked with Chad and Bruce before.
Yeah. But I mean, they were both playing very different roles the last time.
Yes.
You know, Chad was psychotic in Fortress, but in the last movie, he was the hero. So it was definitely fun, you know, turning that on its head, you know, working with him this time as well. And you know, I'm excited for people to see Fortress. Like you said, you know, it's a fast-paced movie. I think it's a lot of fun. There's some great action. And I think, you know, at a human level, there's a great story about like a father and son reconnecting in this craziness. And I think, you know, that type of thing resonates with me because of my relationship I had with my father. He passed away 2 years ago. So, you know, definitely being that human aspect, I can relate with, but also on like a larger level, I think the movie, is just like a really good time. It's a mystery. We don't really know who the good guys or the bad guys are, early on. We're trying to figure stuff out. And it's got some really cool locations, and you know, we tried to make this one feel really big and exciting, and I think you know, the locations and the cinematography and the music and the cast really helped propel this movie a little bit.
Well, the wild card in the film is Chad Michael Murray. When I saw him show up about a third of the way through the film, maybe,
yeah.
He comes in. I think he does his best Nick Cage, but like a controlled Nick Cage. I mean, I just want to see more of him just being wild. It's a pretty amazing turn for the guy from One Tree Hill. Yeah. So
I love this wild. I like that you say Nick Cage, because I'm such a huge Nick Cage fan. I could go on and on for days about Nick Cage. That would be like somebody I would love to work with at some point. But I would say that with Chad, who I love to work with. He's an amazing human being and super talented actor. But Chad, we were kind of going for almost his version of like a Joker. So it's interesting that it came to like a Nick Cage, but like, because I didn't think of it like that, which I should have maybe seen. But it's I think that's actually kind of probably a good explanation of it. He has a lot of fun with it. I mean, Bolzari is really insane, and he's enjoying what he's doing, and you know, the intensity he has later on when things start to go awry is very juxtaposed to the fun insanity he begins with. But I think it's really interesting, because this is a guy who's been preparing for this moment for, you know, years, getting ready to do this attack. And I think it's really fun to see somebody who's living in that and relishing the, you know, basically winning.
And you know, I definitely got a Joker vibe from it, both from a calculating standpoint, but also from an unhinged standpoint. And it was sort of like my mind went from Joker to Michael Keaton. You want to get nuts? To just straight up, you know, A, B, C, D, E. Yeah. Nick Cage is like, that's probably... I could be a combination or none of those, but it was definitely kept my interest. So
yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of fun. Chad has a lot of fun in that movie, and he does a lot of interesting stuff throughout the film. And you know, I think Bolzari, you know, it's interesting, because you can have somebody be so crazy and so wild, and yet he pulls into this human level at certain points where you're just like, wow. Like, you kind of understand, you fully understand where this guy's coming from. And that's kind of one thing that I enjoy is, you know, you have no villain looks at themselves as the villain. Everything they're doing is justified. So, like, you know, he feels he's finally getting the revenge that he deserves for a situation that, when you hear about it, yeah, maybe he's a little bit right. I mean, it's you know, it's one of those things where you're like, okay, like, who is the good guys? Who's the bad guys?
Well, do you remember that movie Swordfish?
Love Swordfish.
I like to rank all movies on a scale from one to Swordfish. And I love what I love about that is it was a crypto crime at a time when, you know, the world was just getting the Matrix and getting, you know, AOL and things like that. So it's nice that there's still, you know, it feels timely in the sense that there is no such thing as like buried treasure. There's no physical representation. There's sort of just this technical money, techno money. And I think it's so funny how quickly that could just go, just like at the end of Swordfish, you know, like he thought he had the money in his account. Next thing you know, Hugh Jackman pulled a switch on him.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting because, you know, crypto is so huge in our lives at this moment, you know, especially given the pandemic and stuff, people started really getting into crypto during that time. And it was awesome to basically do a heist movie involving crypto. It was fun. You know, we had you know, I'd like to think that the movie is almost like parts Jurassic Park without the dinosaurs when you're above ground, and then it's like, you know, like a little bit of a like Star Trek but not on a spaceship, and then like Swordfish, and all mashed together, you know what I mean? So like, yeah, that's kind of what I see when I was making the movie, and maybe that sounds crazy because you'll be like, well, there's no spaceships and there's no but I'm like, no, but it's the vibe I was going for, the vibe. Yeah.
Well, you know, I read a curious credit while I was watching this. This was developed by Emil Hirsch, speed racer Emil Hirsch. Is that, did I get that right?
Yes, it was. It was. Randall Emmett and Emil Hirsch came up with the story for the film.
Okay. So do you know them personally? How did they really, or how did,
well,
you
know, get involved? I know Randall. Randall's the producer of this movie, and I think he's close with Emil. I didn't have interactions with Emil, but Randall brought me on to direct the film.
Okay. Well, so, in a situation like this where everything's fast and, both the production time and the shooting and editing and things like that, how do you go about casting, and is it related to who's available at the time? 'Cause you know, like you said, when you start something, you usually have a release date. So how does the logistics of this come together?
Well, so, I mean, you know, it's not like in a sense, like, you know, you have a release date where it's like, you can't get anybody and blah, blah, blah. Like it's not as hectic as it sounds. It's like, you know, you just know that, like, you can't take a few years to make the movie.
Okay.
You know, it's like, you know, that like, okay, we're making this movie in January. It's going to come out in December. You know what I mean? So, you know, that you like, you know, it's like sort of something like that. So, you know, you're not like spending. So, you know, it's not really, you don't really deal with the kind of availability issues of like, oh no, it's not like a scramble like that. It's just more so like, you know, you don't have the luxury of taking a long time of, you know, prepping and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, the Marvel movies, they'll prep for months and months and months. Mm-hmm. And then they'll shoot like, you know, like a quarter of a page a day, you know, like we're not in that luxurious schedule. We're, you know, more in the indie schedule, but that's not to say that, you know, it's a bad thing. I think, you know, some of our best work comes when our back is against the wall and we got to, you know, figure out something quick. So, mm-hmm.
Well, then kind of going back to what you said a second ago, then how many pages a day or what's your normal, like, what is one day of production for you?
Yeah, that really depends on like, you know, what was scheduled that day. I mean, you know, it's, you know, you have some days that are very heavy page counts. You have some days that are very light. I mean, it just depends based on location, based on, you know, what actors are working that day. It's just, okay, you know, so it varies. There's no like one size fits all. It depends on the production and each project.
Well, one of my favorite production stories, sort of like making it up on the day, was getting Matt Damon in Eurotrip to sing Scotty Doesn't Know.
Oh, yeah.
Because he just happened to be in, I think, Prague when he was doing The Bourne Identity, and they worked it out. But what do you think one of your favorite sort of miracle moments or, you know, serendipity, have you had anything like, not to say Matt Damon caliber, but like what has manifested about you?
No, not idea
you're going to get.
Not Matt Damon caliber, but, you know, in Survive the Game, after the car crash, there was this whole big fight scene that we did not have the time to get like the right kind of coverage for. So I came up with the idea of having the whole fight happen in the background. And so, like, you know, Chad's character is incapacitated in the car and he's starting to like come to, and you're seeing through the windows like everybody having this long fight scene of like slamming each other into the cars and like all this stuff. And you're watching that through the windows in this like really cool oneer. And that was not what was originally planned. That's what I came up with as a solution because, you know, a scene that I needed much more time to shoot. I only had a certain amount of time to shoot now based upon like, you know, falling behind earlier in the day. And I think actually what we ended up doing was cooler than what I had originally planned.
One of the standouts in this film is Bruce Willis. I've been doing this interviewing and running my website for 13 years, and I've never met anybody who's worked with Bruce Willis. So, talk to me about that. Whose decision was to cast it? How high did you jump when you got him, and what's it like?
Well, so this was my second time working with Bruce. So I knew he was on this movie. basically, you know, like he was attached to this movie before I was. So I was, so I was told he was going to do it and asked if I wanted to, you know, work with him again. And we had gotten along on the first one. So like, you know, it made sense. But Bruce brings like some magic to the movie. I mean, there's certain things where it's just like, you know, I know this is going to sound weird, but like where you're looking at the monitor, like when I'm directing and I'm looking at the monitor and you're like, holy shit, that's Bruce Willis. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's sometimes it like registers like while you're looking at it through a, like through a camera, but it's one of those things like, you know, he throws in, you know, one-liners sometimes that are just not, you know, like that weren't scripted that just really work for the movie. He has stuff that he brings that little magic and that spark and he's very friendly. He likes to laugh. We joked around a lot on set. And yeah, I mean, you know, Bruce is awesome. And you know, he seems to elevate everything he's doing because the people around him when they're working with him want to do their best.
Rarely I find myself wanting to keep going down a rabbit hole with characters. I mean, you know, when I love my favorite movie of all time is Big Trouble in Little China. But once it's over, I'm kind of like, you know, Jack can ride off into the fog with the beast and Wang can do his thing with Miao Yin. I'm like, I feel happy. But this one, I just go, son of a bitch, there's got to be more. Tell me, like, now I'm watching TV, the next one. So it's a shame that you're not in it, but are dealing with it.
Without giving any spoilers, we do have a cliffhanger ending of Fortress 1. So I'm glad that there's a Fortress 2 to clear that up. It would suck to end on a cliffhanger and have nobody like make a sequel.
It's like what was that? Toy Story 2, they had a fictitious climax of the characters from the Woody's Roundup show.
It never had the climax.
Or even like what was it? Galaxy Quest. It's like the continuing adventures of
Buckaroo Banzai ends with them saying like, hey, you know, like Buckaroo Banzai will return in blah, blah, blah. And then it never happens.
Still waiting, hasn't happened. Waiting.
I mean, I'm surprised with everything old is new again and then going back and, you know, doing movies from, you know, old time films. I'm surprised they haven't been like, you know what, let's just do the sequel to Buckaroo Banzai.
But, you know, the funniest one that I'm not funniest, but the one that I just was not anticipating a follow-up is the new Matrix. I mean, holy crap. Can you believe 23 years later, we're going to get back to the Matrix? I my mind can't process that.
Has it really been 23 years?
Yeah, I think the first one came out in 99. So almost 23 years.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it seems the Matrix was kind of before its time, even though it was like, you know, so it makes sense, you know, that they're doing one. I'm curious if it's I've heard rumors that it's a sequel to the first one, not to the sequels.
They're going the Halloween route, huh?
Yeah. And then I've heard that it's a sequel to the whole series. So I don't know. There's a lot of speculation on the Twitterverse. So it's like, we'll see, but I'm definitely curious to see it. I mean, you know, Keanu Reeves is back doing big action with the John Wick stuff, so it makes sense.
I still can't believe that worked. It's kind of like Cobra Kai. It should not be that good, and it should not work, but somehow it does. But well, let's get back to you and your directing. One thing I've always wondered, this is a very geeky question, but it seems like I can't notice actors blinking very often. Is there something in film school that teaches actors just keep their eyelids propped up so it really helps them convey what they're doing? I don't know. Am I making that up?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. Maybe. I mean, I would, but, you know, I definitely, I think people blink. I don't know. I haven't really been paying attention to that in my movies, to be honest, you know?
Okay.
I mean, like, I know that, like, the only time I pay attention is I don't want to cut on a blink, you know? So, like, if, like, you don't want their eyes to be closed when you cut or their eyes to be closed when you're cutting to them.
Okay.
So, but, yeah, no, outside of that, I don't know. It's not really been something that I've been cognizant of.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I got my question out to the universe, even though I feel like it was probably the dumbest thing I've ever asked.
I did a horrible job of answering it.
But how do you like to work with actors? Do you, you know, do you do heavy rehearsals? Do you let them make it up on the day? Is it a combination
I think it's all different per actor, if that makes sense. Like, you know, you kind of have to talk to people in like the language that they talk in, if that makes sense. So like, you know, you find out, you feel out the actor and you understand, like, you know, how to communicate with them specifically. That's why I said, you know, a lot of time I love working with the same actors, because once I learn that person's communication style and language, you know, I know how to work with them. And so like, there's a feeling out process, but you know, a lot of time what I do is I imagine every character as a blank canvas. And what I'll do is I'll take my ideas about the character, and the actor will take their ideas about the character. We throw them at the canvas, and whatever works for both of us, we use to paint the picture of who that person is, you know, both on and off the page, you know, who they were before this movie started, creating the backstory. I like to have a lot of conversations that infer what is not in this script. Like, you know, what is not in this script that we need to understand about this person's motivation, about where they came from, about, you know, like, you know, their upbringing, like, who is this person, to make them a full rounded, living, breathing person. And then from there, you know, we have discussions. A lot of the time, maybe we'll tweak some dialogue together that makes more sense for based on what we're talking about. Each collaboration is its own animal. It's its own thing. It's a different thing. But I very much enjoy working with, you know, actors and having those conversations. And then from there, once we spend that time talking about that and going through the script, from there, it's really just shaping. I like to shape what they do. So like, they'll give me something on set and I'll kind of like just chisel away at it and shape, you know, okay, like we'll do this a little smaller this time, or like a little bigger this time, you know, we'll try this one, you know, maybe instead of like a more outright anger, maybe it's more like seething, bubbling up from inside you. You know, we'll try different things. We'll shape the moments based on the conversations we've had.
If you do kind of change it, I mean, does that one now instance, does that find itself trying to sew itself through the rest of the film? Because if a character, you know, becomes a different animosity or something, that should maybe have ramifications later on.
For sure. So we definitely make sure stuff tracks, but I mean, you know, we're finding like what works best for like the emotional moment. I think, you know, a lot of the time it also depends on like who the other character is in the scene, right? Because like, you know, maybe this person would normally be angry, but they, you know, what we've established is they have, you know, a soft spot for this other character. Well, then maybe they kind of reel it in around that person. You know, it's and just that more gentleness on their side might show that affinity. So like a lot of the time, you know, we have those conversations and, you know, I'll say like, how do you feel about this person? You know, how does your character feel about this person? And we kind of go through those conversations to like fully understand and make it a full rounded thing. Because you don't, in life, we don't treat everybody exactly the same. So like, it's, you know, you want to have those dynamics clear within how people talk to each other.
From a consumer, you have no idea that these type of conversations take place and this much thought goes into something. I mean, even if it's two people sitting at a table, I mean, just the amount of planning to get that right and frame it. And it's amazing.
You know, there's a lot. I mean, if I go through any of my scripts, every single script of mine has color-coded notes on every single page. Like, you know, the pages of the script are, you know, hundreds of notes, color-coded that I've written, handwritten. I've drawn overhead blocking maps of every scene of what happens. I have like a thorough shot list for every single scene. I've written like the motivation for each line, why the character's saying certain things. And then, you know, just like notes for each department on what I want what color I want on the table, all the different color schemes, everything really, you know, how I want the lighting to be, you know, everything's written out and planned in prep so that, you know, I feel like the more prepared I am, the more I'm able to have fun on set and find the magic in those moments, because I'm not, you know, trying to go, oh crap, what do we do? What do we do? I've already come up with my like A plan, B plan, C plan, and I'm just able to effortlessly, you know, flow into whichever one based upon, you know, how it's going in those moments.
Well, a couple interviews, I think I'm making this up. I talked to Zalbat Manglij after he did The East, and if I remember right, he said he doesn't do storyboarding because it he feels it confines him, or it makes him too not open to sort of the magic on set. But how open, I mean, it sounds like you leave yourself open to both artist interpretation and trying different takes and stuff, but when do you actually say, hey, here's what it's got to be, I'm sorry, and you know?
I mean, it's you know, what I think is, like, you know, you have to, it's, I hone everything towards the overall vision. So as long as it fits within the world of that, you know, it makes sense. Like, I'm not going to derail somebody else's creativity if it fits within the world that I'm trying to create. You know, I'm a firm believer, you know, and I do all that preparation of a shot list. I love storyboarding. I storyboard, but I'm not married to anything that I do, because I'm a firm believer that a director doesn't always have to have the best ideas. They just have to recognize good ones. And so a lot of the times, you know, it's why you have so many brilliant people. And there's those conversations. Somebody's able to make a better point than me. Like, if I'm talking with an actor and they're like, you know, really, this is what, you know, makes the most sense for my character. And if they're right, I'm not going to say, nope, it's my way. Like, you know, my overall job is to shape everything to make the best movie possible. And so, like, you know, I am going to play to the people around me's strong suits as well. That's another thing people don't really necessarily talk about, but, like, you know, certain actors might be stronger at doing a certain thing. And so maybe when you cast that person, you may have originally envisioned it one way, but you see that somebody's much better at doing something else. Like, maybe a character is much better an actor is much better at being comedic. You didn't originally see the role as a comedic role, but you might start sprinkling in a little comedy because that plays towards that person's strong suit. You know, so what I do is I don't set myself up for failure. I work within what I have and the tools I have and play towards the strong suits of the people that are involved.
On that note, what do you think has been one of the biggest surprises to you? I mean, with the amount you've touched and things you've done, you probably have an embarrassment of riches, but what are some of the things that just go, man, I was so happy to be on that day, or this character did this, or, you know, Bruce said that and everybody laughed or whatever.
You know, I mean, I think there's just so many instances, it's hard to just point out, but, like, you know, I think just, like, you know, the fact that, you know, I learn something every day that I'm making a movie, no matter what. I've been directing feature films for, you know, over 11 years at this point, and every single day I'm learning something new. You know, that's, I think, the most awesome thing. And then I think, you know, also the people that I work with, you know, can bring different perspective and insight to a role, or to, you know, to the look of the film, or to, you know, stuff that I may not have thought of. And, you know, I may have thought, you know, going in, it was a really good idea for, you know, this scene to be, you know, shot a certain way, but my DP talks to me about how, well, if we did this, it would kind of look more like this. And I see, like, you know, the mock-up of what he's thinking, and I'm like, wow, that actually makes way more sense. That looks better. Mm-hmm. You know, again, you know, I'm not saying that happens every time, you know, like, I'd say a lot of the time we're doing exactly what I planned, but it's, you know, I love leaving room for that collaboration, because a lot of the time you can also find so much magic from the brilliant ideas of those around you.
So what do you do to unwind? Because I imagine being in movies, even though you love movies, how do you get away from movies?
I watch movies. I hang out with friends, and I like going out for sushi. Spend time with my cats. A cat named Martin Scorsese.
Oh, very nice.
Pretty cool. Another cat named Billie Holiday. You know, I just, yeah, I would say, I just kind of the same way everybody else unwinds, I guess.
I was a big movie fan. I grew up watching movies. I think the first movie I saw was probably Peter Pan, the cartoon in the,
oh, yeah,
in the
great
theater.
Yeah.
I've gotten recently, in the last 6-7 years, into vinyl collecting. And so my friend runs another website. And I've gotten to the point where I just feel I've been so focused, especially running the site, that even though I'm not in the film industry, I just feel so drawn to it and focused on it, that I feel like getting away from it is not following the sequels and the ever expanding narratives. And I just like to just put my biggest headphones on, you know, put a vinyl on, and that's how I find some relief.
So. Yeah, no, I started collecting vinyl also. So I definitely like listening to vinyl. I like, you know, I play fantasy football.
Oh, cool.
I like that, you know, I'm number one in my league. I'm 11-2. So let's go. Yeah.
We have one in our office, and I declined because I would probably lose. I'm just terrible at gambling and, you know, any kind of chance, but.
Yeah. My league is all with people I went to high school with. So, like, we've all been friends, like, you know, a long time. So, you know, the shit-talking ability is worth, you know, the price of admission, you know.
What's the most exciting time? I mean, I hate to just into, you know, globally ask questions like this, but with your wealth of experience and all the things you touch on, I mean, what really excites you the most, or what's been the high, you know, before you're 30, what's been, yes, I can't believe I achieved this level.
I mean, you know, it's really awesome to work with, you know, iconic, you know, actors and actresses, you know, to work with people that are globally recognizable is awesome. And to collaborate and to see and understand why these people became so, you know, famous, because they have that magic and that ability. And it's also really weird and surreal to, like, you know, not only work with somebody like that, but, you know, these are people that, like, I grew up watching in movies and television. And it's so weird to, like, you know, be at lunch on set, like, hanging out with them, talking to them. And you're like, this is weird. It, like, it's amazing. It's surreal, but it's like, it's weird. You're like, wow. Like, you know, if I told, you know, 10-year-old me that I would be hanging out with, you know, Bruce Willis or Mel Gibson on set, like, I'd think that, you know, I was high. Like, you know, it's like, it's just, you know, it's surreal and it's amazing. And it's also, you know, the most rewarding thing is to have something that you plan for and you imagine and you visualize and you see, and you come up with all these different things that, like, for the characters and the look of the people. And then, like, just, and the way it's going to be shot, and you do all this planning. And then when you keep thinking, oh, this is how it's going to look, and this, and then to see it in front of a camera actually start to come together, and you're like, wow, like, you know, this was just an idea months ago and now it's a thing. Like, that's, you know, that's kind of amazing.
So you've worked with John McClane. You also have worked with Scott Farkas from A Christmas Story, Zach Ward.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, man. Zach is a legend, man. I love that guy. He's one of my best friends in the entire world. I think we've worked together like 11 times at this point. We've done so many projects together. He's been my writing partner. We've written scripts together. You know, him and I are very close. I'm super close with his wife. You know, it's like, they're like family. I love them very much. And Zach is just such a talented actor. I look at him as like my chameleon, when it's like, oh yeah, I have this character. I can put Zach in it, even though he looks nothing like it. And we just, like, change his hair and give him tattoos and give him a completely different look. You know, I just, like, chameleon him to the roles, because he can handle it. And he's such a talented actor. You know, and I can't wait to see, you know, I love working with Zach. I think he's a phenomenal actor. And I can't wait to see all the stuff he does outside of me too, because, you know, I think, you know, that guy deserves to be working a lot.
If I could ask one final question, you know, you work with icons, and some people, if they can't race cars anymore, they slow down. If they can't, you know, climb buildings anymore, they don't get that high. So Bruce Willis cannot do the things that he's known for, but he's still intimidating and delivers a great line. But how do you shoot with somebody who's starting to get, I guess, limited mobility or just a little older? I mean, he still walks around and shoots guns, but how do some of the shots and sequencing work?
You know, we shoot it like a regular movie. It's just like, you know, we don't expect Bruce to jump out of a building, you know. you know, and then you do stuff with stunt doubles as well, like, if you really need that. But, you know, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of time, like, you know, some of these actors are older than they were when they became super famous. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Die Hard was a long time ago. So, like, you know, obviously it's, you know, people don't move the same way as they did back then. You know, but I think Bruce is still, you know, he shoots a gun. He still does, you know, he still does action. And I feel like, you know, you really feel it in Fortress. Like he's involved in these action sequences and does some cool stuff. You know, and I think, you know, you focus on their ability as actors as well.
Well, James, I want to commend you for not only what you've done with the film, but just your general outlook, the experience that you're able to share, and gosh, just how much you looks like the future's just, you know, springboard for you. So I look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you for your time. But what are you doing for the rest of the year? Just to wrap this up,
I am going to spend time with my family. I have a nephew and my mom and sisters that I've been neglecting because I've not been home because I've been filming, and I'm going to spend time with family and friends.
Excellent. Well, everyone, check out Fortress. Comes out on December 17th in select theaters, and then Blu-ray and DVD the following week. We'll catch you in the sequel.